$5, and you can keep it either way. Just think about it for 7 days. And if in 7 days you still want to retire, you can keep the million. I handed him back the check and said, in good conscience, I can't take it. I know in my heart I'm done. He asked me why, and I told him, the older you get as a professional athlete, the more time and commitment you have to put in, no matter how good you are. I just don't have the energy physically or mentally to train for 3 to 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, to get ready for the next training camp. Off-season training was essential. For one thing, it stopped you from getting seriously hurt. People say, oh, Gretzky never got hit, which is kind of ridiculous. Guys sticking and whacking and basically tackling you to slow you down is part of the game. You had to train very hard, for hours and hours each day. Cardio, Taibo, light weights, 3-on-3 basketball, tennis to stay quick and agile. Training in the off-season is the reason Jágr is still playing, and how Gordie Howe made it to 52, and Messier and Chelios were able to go for so long. I told Jim, hockey isn't the reason I'm retiring. I could go to practice every day, play every game, travel, compete. That part of it is still great. It's not about playing hockey. I can still play. In fact, I wish I could play another 10 years. But I know I don't have 10 years of training left. My parents were staying with us at our apartment in New York. My dad had driven me to the first NHL game I ever went to at Maple Leaf Gardens when I was 6 years old. I asked my dad to drive with me to my last game to complete the circle. It's quiet in New York on Sundays, easy to get around. I was only 15 minutes to the garden, so I was looking forward to our special father-son time. When I got home after the game, Janet said, how was the drive? I said, you know, it was really hard. She said, what do you mean? I said, he spent the entire ride trying to talk me into playing one more year. That final game at Madison Square Garden, I played with 50 sticks, one for each of my teammates, and the rest for different people and charities and organizations like the Hockey Hall of Fame who had requested them. Leachy made the whole night really special with a speech he made in the locker room after the game. I can't remember it word for word, but he talked about how much fun we had playing together. He let me know that being his teammate was special, and he thanked me for everything I did for the game overall. He made us laugh when he said that I was just a part of their team, the guy sitting next to you until every once in a while he'd look over and think, holy cow, that's Wayne Gretzky. He wasn't one for long talks, but what he said will always mean a lot to me. I enjoyed Leachy's company so much. That's what I was going to miss most. Every single day for 3 years, I'd sit in the locker room beside him, drinking a cup of coffee, talking about what happened the night before, or about our families, or about another team or player. We used to giggle and laugh all the time. But hey, life goes on. I think for the Rocket, when he got on the ice, trouble seemed to disappear for him. It was his happy place. It's how I felt, and I think it was the same thing for Gordie and lots of the guys. When you are on the ice, nothing else seems to matter except going out and doing what you love to do. If I had 3 points, I wanted 4. I always played full throttle no matter what the score was. If you're playing well, it doesn't matter how old you are. In professional sports, you play from buzzer to buzzer, and you don't stop. You never let up. That never changed. I know that family and kids and all that, that's the most important thing in life. But doing what you love to do is something that energizes a guy, something that gives a man's life purpose. The Rocket, Gordie, and a few others have had the privilege of retiring on our own terms. And I think for guys like us, it's always better to leave the game before the fire goes out. Chapter 13. Victory at Squaw Valley. The Forgotten Miracle. Hockey teams love being underdogs. I can't speak with much authority about other sports, but in hockey, feeling like the odds are against you has the effect that many people associate with confidence. When no one expects you to win, you're loose. And a loose hockey team is dangerous. In 1981, the Oilers faced the heavily favored Montreal Canadiens in the first round. They were the Wales Conference and Adams Division champions and had finished 29 points ahead of us in the standings. No one gave us a chance, and for good reason. They were the better team, hands down. The first round was best of five back then, and the first two games were in Montreal. We won the first game 6-3. We had no business winning game two, but Andy Moog stood on his head and stopped 40 shots. We won that one 3-1. When we got back to Edmonton, we were a different team. Still loose, but now we knew what we were capable of. We swept the series with a 6-3 win. I sometimes think the American victory at Squaw Valley was a little like that. The 8th Winter Games, held in 1960 at a pretty little ski resort in Squaw Valley, close to Los Angeles, marked the beginning of the Olympics' modern era. Scoring was computerized, and a snow-scraping, ice-flooding machine called a Zamboni was introduced. For the first time, the games were televised. CBS was the host broadcaster, with Walter Cronkite at the anchor desk. Walt Disney had designed cartoon-like statues of athletes representing the various sports, and Hollywood stars mixed with the athletes and the public. The 1960 U.S. Olympic hockey team was made up of the very best college players from across the country. Players like Bill and Bob Cleary, John Mayasich, Paul Johnson, Jack McCartan in net, and two brothers with one of the most famous names in American hockey, Bill and Roger Christian. But the American media, which didn't pay much attention to hockey in those days, didn't see them as contenders. No one gave them much of a chance. The team's new head coach was Jack Riley from West Point. Riley named Jack Corrane, a tough, stay-at-home defenseman, as his captain. Corrane brought a veteran presence. He was a 31-year-old firefighter and had played all the way back in the 1948 Olympics. The opening ceremonies lasted only an hour compared with at least 4 hours today. Vice President Richard Nixon welcomed 740 athletes from 30 countries. 9 of those nations had brought a hockey team. The Americans were predicted to place no higher than 5th behind Canada, the Soviet Union, Sweden, and Czechoslovakia. To everyone's surprise, the Americans went undefeated in their first 4 games, but they had yet to play Canada. The sports writers gave them no chance, predicting a blowout where Canada might win by 7 goals. The Canadians had been playing NHL teams as a warm-up to the Olympics, and some of them would go on to great careers in the NHL. In those days, there was no distinct Team Canada. The team that had won the previous year's Allen Cup, awarded to the top senior league in the country, simply put on the maple leaf and headed to the Olympics. The winners in 1959 were the Kitchener-Waterloo Dutchmen, coached by Bobby Bauer. Bauer, of course, was a future Hall of Famer. He'd played right wing on the Boston Bruins Kraut line with Woody Dumart and Milt Schmidt. The Dutchman, with Bauer behind the bench, had also represented Canada at the 1956 Olympics, so they were clearly a pretty special team. Defenseman Harry Sinden would become the Bruins' coach and general manager for 28 seasons and would win a Stanley Cup when Bobby Orr scored his famous overtime goal in 1970. He was also behind the bench for Team Canada in 1972. Bobby Rousseau would go on to score 245 NHL goals and win 4 cups, and their backup goalie, Cesar Maniago, would join the Leafs the next year and then go on to play 9 seasons for the Minnesota North Stars. Defenseman Darryl Sly would see 3 seasons of NHL action, and so would forward Cliff Pennington. So the Canadians were solid, The Americans, meanwhile, had played college teams across the country and lost to half of them. The Americans knew that their only chance against Canada was to get ahead early. So they attacked hard in the first period. Bob Cleary batted in a rebound while Harry Sindon knocked him down in front of the net, but Canada tied the score. In the second period, Paul Johnson intercepted a pass and raced down the ice on a clear breakaway. When he got to the blue line, he let go a perfect slap shot that beat Canada's goalie, future Boston Bruin Don Head, over his shoulder into the top corner. From that point, the Canadians got desperate. They took 32 shots on McCartan in the last two periods, but they couldn't beat him. Sindon remembers that they had scoring chance after scoring chance, but were getting nowhere. Afterward, a newspaper reporter wrote that Jack McCartan had been operating with radar. The Americans hung on for a 2-1 win and rushed off the bench to grab McCartan, throwing gloves and sticks in the air as though they'd just won the Stanley Cup. Suddenly, the dream of a home ice gold medal seemed possible for the Americans. But they would still have to get by the Soviets. They'd never beaten them. Before the tournament, one reporter had called the U.S. team a ragtag crew of insurance salesmen and carpenters. But after the win over the Canadians, American fans suddenly discovered hockey. 10,000 people were packed into a stadium built for 8,500. The American trainer even had to kick California Governor Pat Brown off the bench. As the clock ticked down to the end of the second period, with the score tied at 2, American winger Roger Christian got a penalty for slashing. In those days, you had to serve the full 2 minutes, regardless of whether your opponent scored on the power play, and you weren't allowed to ice the puck. But the Americans killed it off without allowing a single shot on goal. In the third period, the U.S. started to take the play to the Russians. The Christian brothers, Roger and Bill, put the U.S. up 3-2. The Russians retaliated by pressing hard, peppering McCartan, but he kept everything out, even a shot on a clear breakaway. The Russians had never trailed so late in a game. It was also the first time they'd ever pulled their goalie. Nikolai Puchkov didn't even know to go to the bench for an extra attacker. He simply skated over to the side of the rink and sat on the boards. And suddenly, it was over. The American team was on its way to making history. The gold medal game set them up against the Czechs, whom they'd beaten 3 times in the past couple of weeks. The game started at 8 a.m. There were only 1,000 fans in the stands. The ref dropped the puck. The Czechs skated it into the American zone, took a shot, and scored. Not the way you want to open a gold medal game. But the Americans came back in a seesaw battle through the period. The score was tied 3-3 after the first. The Czechs notched the only goal in the second to lead 4-3, and went into the break just 20 minutes away from the gold. In the second period intermission, a strange thing happened. The captain of the Russian team, Nikolai Sologubov, came into the U.S. dressing room. This was just never done. He couldn't speak English, but he kept putting his hand over his mouth. American captain Jack Curran figured out what he was saying. He was telling them to take some oxygen to combat the 6,200-foot altitude at Squaw Valley. As a firefighter, it made sense to Curran. He said, "Okay, Solly, bring it in." So Logubov rolled a tank into the room, and a few of the players tried it. The Russian wasn't acting out of the goodness of his heart. If the Czechs won, the Soviets would be out of the medals. The way it was set up, if Czechoslovakia lost the game against the U.S., they would finish fourth with a 3-4 record, which meant the Soviets would win bronze with a 4-2-1 record. But if the Czechs won, the Canadians would win gold, the Czechs silver, and the Americans bronze. Whether it was the oxygen or something else, the U.S. was a different team in the third period. They threw everything they had at the Czechs. Roger Christian moved in and tied the score. They kept shooting from the point and deflecting in the shots. Then Bill Cleary skated through the entire Czech team and deked the goalie. They scored 6 in the third and won 9-5. Christian played the game of his life, scoring 4 goals. Even though this was the first U.S. gold medal in hockey, there weren't any celebrations. Only Captain Jack Carain was handed a medal. The rest of the team found them on their bunks in their rooms. Hockey wasn't an American sport yet. Outside a few hockey communities like Minnesota and Michigan, there wasn't much interest. The team won the gold on Sunday, and most of the guys simply went back to work on Monday. One interesting side note to the tournament was the battle of future equipment moguls. The famous Bauer Company was run by Bobby Bauer's father-in-law. And on the American team, Bill and Roger Christian went on to found the Christian Stick Company. In fact, Roger's nephew Dave used a Christian stick in Lake Placid. But more on that later. Much more importantly, the American victory in Squaw Valley started to make hockey an American game. In 1981, when the Oilers hit the ice for Game 3 in Edmonton, we got a 10-minute standing ovation. Before 1979, people in Edmonton were either Leafs fans or Canadiens fans. When we came back from Montreal, everyone in Edmonton was an Oilers fan. I think American fans started to feel something like that in 1960. Hockey was their game, too. And that made the game better. Chapter 14. The Greatest of Them All. In the 1960s, you were either a Leafs fan, a Canadiens fan, a Red Wings fan, a Bruins fan, a Rangers fan, or a Blackhawks fan. My grandmother was a huge Maple Leafs fan. My next-door neighbor, Syl Rosetto, was a huge Montreal Canadiens fan. He had the first color TV in the neighborhood, and so I used to spend a lot of time over there watching Hockey Night in Canada. Syl's favorite player was Béliveau. Once you identify your guy or your team, you don't really change. I was a fan of Gordie Howe's, and that never changed. The greatest Christmas gift I ever got was when I was 5. It was a Gordie Howe sweater. I can remember opening it and putting it on like it was yesterday. Every kid loves Christmas, right? But I never really wanted anything for Christmas except that jersey. It was wool, and it really itched. My neck would be all red, but it didn't matter. I wore it every time I went onto the ice in the backyard. At that time, Gordie wrote a hockey column in the newspaper, and my dad would read it out loud. Things like how Sid Abel had taught him, "Anytime you see that net, drill it." And there was a song the radio stations played during hockey season called "Gordie Howe is the Greatest of Them All." When I laced up my skates or walked to school or my dad drove us somewhere and I looked out the window, I'd be hearing that song in my head. "Gordie Howe is the greatest of them all, the greatest of them all, yes, the greatest of them all. You can have your choice of all the rest, but if you're a Howe fan, you've got the very best." Sometimes even today, I'll be doing something and it will run through my mind. Everybody's idea of the classic hockey player is the bull-necked Saskatchewan farm boy who learned the game playing on frozen ponds. That was Gordie Howe. He grew up during the Depression without many luxuries. But according to Gordie, that's what got him into hockey. A neighbor was selling odds and ends to make ends meet. And that's how the first pair of skates found their way into the Howe household. From that point on, Gordie was a hockey player. The first NHL team to scout him was the New York Rangers, where his older brother played. Gordie attended the Rangers training camp in Winnipeg when he was 15. Coach Frank Boucher, the same Frank Boucher that Conn Smythe signed to the Rangers as a player, and GM Lester Patrick, wanted to sign him there and then. But Gordie was homesick, and just wanted to get back to Saskatoon. When the Red Wings came calling the next year, however, he was game, and ended up at their training camp in Windsor, Ontario. This time it was Jack Adams who wanted him to sign, and he did. It took him a while to work his way through the minors. He was riding the bench in Omaha until he hopped over the boards to defend his roommate, who was getting thumped in a fight. His coach was impressed, and Gordy took a regular shift after that, and ended up dropping the gloves more than a few times. He was only 18 years old, but he was as strong as an ox from working for his father's construction company. He could carry a 90-pound bag of concrete under each arm. By the following year, 1946-47, he was in the NHL. But the greatest player in history had a slow start to his career. Only 7 goals and 15 assists in his first season. It shows how difficult it can be to judge a hockey player when he's 18. Even Gordie Howe had to learn how to succeed in the league. But by 1949-50, he was putting the puck in the net. And the next year he won the Art Ross Trophy for most points in a season. He won it again the next year, along with the Hart Trophy for league MVP. Then he won them both again the following year. And so on. The most dominant player of his era, and possibly any era, had arrived. Ted Lindsay said that before each season, Gordy used to worry that he wasn't going to make the team, and so he was tough on the other right wingers in training camp. Gordy would say, "The only way that guy is getting my job is over my dead body." In a 2014 TSN interview I did with Gordy, he told me that he thought the original six had more depth in the talent pool than today's teams have. He said that back then there were easily 8 players with NHL talent who could take your place if given the chance, and that even if you were hurt, you'd stay in the lineup because you might not get back in. And that's what made the game so competitive and intense. Not that I believe for a second that there were 8 guys who could take his place. I don't think there has ever been even one. Gordy was a complete player. He was ambidextrous. He could put either hand on top of his stick. And so through the course of a game, he'd switch to protect the puck, or when he was deking. But he had a great backhand shot too. Especially when he was cutting in off the wing, he had so much momentum behind him that he could let a shot go with a lot of power on that backhand. Because he shot with both hands, Gordy's stick didn't have a lot of curve. He always shaved around the toe of the blade to round it. Now sticks are custom made, but back then you just got what you got. Blades came very square, and so Gordy would take a rasp to the toe. His philosophy was that the more blade you put on the ice, the easier it is to handle the puck at your feet. If your blade wasn't rounded, the point would dig into the ice and stop you from getting enough power on your shot. The other thing he liked was a short stick. It seemed to help both him and his son Mark stick handle. I think that's because they skated in a more upright style and it pulled the puck in. Gordy's advice was to hold your stick with your top hand just as you'd hold a hammer when you're driving a nail. It will give you the most leverage, and you won't get your wrist broken. Gordy was so strong that he'd often break more than 100 sticks a season. He could bend a solid wooden stick the way Patrick Kane bends a modern composite. But he didn't have to reach down the shaft to get off a hard shot. His wrists were so strong that he could keep his hands together at the top of the stick and still rip it. Goalies would have no idea that he was even thinking about shooting. That strength allowed him to play along the boards, holding guys off with one hand and carrying the puck with the other. And it allowed him to set up in the slot and defy anyone to move him. He could skate through the middle with guys draped all over him. And if he wanted the puck, he was going to push you off it. But the legend of Howe's strength doesn't do him justice. You don't rewrite the record book just by being big. His real genius was that he didn't need to bulldoze through the other team. He moved smoothly and methodically, following effortless patterns around the ice. He never seemed to have to hurry, but the puck always found him. And he could always find the open man. Part of that is just the respect the rest of the league had for him. Guys knew that if they tried to beat him one-on-one, they were probably going to lose. That allowed him to dictate the pace. Sometimes that's a trade-off you have to make against a player that dominant. At the start of the 1950-51 season, Gordy's fifth in the NHL. He was the only player in the league wearing a helmet, made out of leather, because of an injury he'd suffered the previous season. The first game of the semifinals, on March 28, 1950, was a battle. The Leafs were going for their fourth straight cup. Halfway through the third period, the Wings were behind 4-0. Gordy took a run at Leafs captain Ted Kennedy, and Kennedy stepped out of the way. Gordy went headfirst into the boards with his teammate Jack Stewart right behind him. Stewart was known as one of the heaviest hitters in the league, and he'd had his sights on Kennedy as well. Gordy hit the board so hard that the crowd went quiet. Then blood started to pool around his head. He'd fractured his nose and his cheekbone, his eyeball was scratched, and he suffered a serious concussion. They operated on Gordy at midnight. A neurosurgeon named Dr. Frederick Schreiber drilled a hole in his skull to relieve the pressure. Gordy later said that it was awful listening to the drill and feeling the force of it penetrating his skull. While Gordy recovered, the Wings went on to beat the Leafs and the Rangers and to win the cup. It was the start of a 4-year cup run in 6 seasons, 1950, 1952, 1954, and 1955. The incident left Gordy with a facial tic that made him blink. When I was with the Indianapolis Racers in 1978, and Gordy was with the New England Whalers, I once looked over at him during a game. We had been friendly for a while, as his son Murray and I played together in Toronto when I was 15, and Gordy would come to watch the games as often as he could. I thought I saw him winking at me, kind of wishing me good luck. I mentioned this to one of my teammates, who told me, "Nah, he just blinks a lot. In fact, some of his teammates call him Blinky." Stories about Gordy Howe tend to fall into one of two categories. In the first category are the examples of his generosity and graciousness. He would help strangers. He was adored by children. And he was unfailingly polite. The only enemies Gordy ever had were the 19 guys sitting on the opposing bench. But those 19 guys had to be on their best behavior. That leads us to the second category, the stories about how intimidating he could be. One of his mottos was, "Do unto others before they do unto you." But he could be counted on to do unto others after as well. In fact, he was known for his long memory. If you ever crossed Gordy Howe, your punishment was coming. It was just a question of when. Before he was known as Mr. Hockey, he was Mr. Elbows. He left a trail of broken noses, missing teeth, and stitches through the league. And then there was the Gordy Howe hat trick, a goal, an assist, and a fight. Players love them. And if a guy has 2 of the 3, his teammates will try to set him up for the 3rd. If you look at the players who have racked up a few Gordy Howe hat tricks, you can see why it's something to be proud of. Guys like Brendan Shanahan, Cam Neely, and Jerome McGinley are in the double digits. But the funny thing is, Gordy had only a couple. And it wasn't because he didn't score that much. It was because he actually didn't fight all that often. That was because no one wanted to fight him. Only a true heavyweight would tangle with Gordy, and it was a risky move even for a guy like that. There was one fight in Gordy's career that probably served as a warning. It started because of Eddie Shack, who always played with a full head of steam. This was a guy who traveled in a straight line, and if you got in his way, he'd go through you, not around you. His line mate with the Leafs, Bert Olmsted, loved Eddie despite their rocky start. Eddie was skating wildly and accidentally hit Bert hard. Bert got up, grabbed Eddie by the jersey, and said, "What color is this, Eddie?" Eddie said, "Blue." Bert said, "Right. So whenever you see a blue uniform, steer clear of it." Back in 1959, 9 years after Gordy's brain operation, Eddie Shack was a rookie with the Rangers. On February 1st, the Rangers were up 4-1 in a game against the Wings. Eddie was being a pest, so Gordy sliced his ear for a couple of stitches with his stick. But Shack didn't get the message. Later in the game, he was mixing it up with Gordy's teammate, Red Kelly. When Gordy made a move to sort things out, Rangers heavyweight Lou Fontanato grabbed Gordy and probably wished he hadn't. Gordy's later account was, "Lou was coming like a madman. It took me a while to get the gloves off, and then things were busy." Fontanato's version was that Gordy had rearranged his nose. To this day, photos of Fontanato's face are pretty gruesome. He underwent surgery to straighten out his nose, but he finished the game before heading to the hospital. Gordy did eventually work things out with Eddie Shack, who by that time was with the Leafs. In January 1961, Detroit was at Maple Leaf Gardens when Eddie and Gordy collided. Gordy went down and was knocked out cold when his head hit the ice. He got up feeling dizzy and with a bad headache, so they took him to the hospital for x-rays. He'd had a concussion and needed 10 stitches. Gordy didn't blame Shaq, but Jack Adams was furious. In a game soon after, the score was 1-1. It was well known that Eddie was taking classes to read and write, so Jack yelled at him from the bench, calling him an illiterate so-and-so. Eddie rushed the puck down the ice, put it in the net, and then skated past the bench and said, "Hey, Jack, that's spelled S-C-O-R-E. In 1967, when Eddie was with the Bruins, he knocked Gordy out again. He came in on him elbows up and sent him off balance. Gordy hit his head hard on the ice. In those days, the NHL would hold a summer golf tournament and bring in someone from every Original Six team. Eddie was sitting with Gordy. Gordy said, "Shacky, you don't hit me, and I don't hit you. Put her there." Gordy held his hand out. Shaq said, "Gordy, it's a deal," and they shook on it. At the start of the next season, during a Boston-Detroit game, Coach Harry Sinden called Shaq over to the bench. He said, "Eddie, Gordy Howe is the meanest, most competitive man out there. What are you doing skating around him with your head down?" Shaq replied, "Oh, don't worry about it. We got a deal." It stands to reason that a guy as tough and as selfless as Gordy Howe would be the ultimate teammate. And who would know that better than his sons, Mark and Marty? In 1973, they were drafted into the WHA as underage juniors, just as I would be later. Gordy thought about it for a while, then offered his services to his son's new team, the Houston Aeros. He had retired from the NHL 2 years earlier, and his sweater was hanging from the rafters in Detroit. He was 45 years old, and his arthritis was bothering him. But he had a lot more hockey left in him. It took him a while to get back into shape, but on opening night, Mark and Marty Howe were playing with their father. The WHA was a tough league, but God help anyone who took liberties with a player with Howe on the back of his sweater. And Gordy wasn't just riding shotgun. He scored over 30 goals almost every year he was in the league. Tom Webster, our coach in L.A. from 1989 to 1992, we made it to the playoffs all 3 seasons he was there, had played with Gordy in both the NHL and the WHA, so he knew him well. Webby tells a story that captures in a nutshell why players thought so much of Gordy. Webby joined the Wings in 1970-71. It was Gordy's last year in the NHL. In order to help make room for Webby, the coach, Ned Harkness, decided to put Gordy back on blue line to play defense. That way, Webby would have a chance to play with Alex Delvecchio and Frank Mihaljevic. That's a bit like asking Mario Lemieux to play defense. Not that he couldn't do it, but this is one of the biggest stars the league has ever seen. Gordie Howe had played on the production line with Ted Lindsay and Sid Abel since 1948-49, 2 years before Delvecchio and 9 years before Mihaljevic even joined the Wings. And he'd led the league in scoring from 1950-51 to 1953-54. The only guy who came close to his numbers was the Rocket in 1953-54, and he was 14 points behind. Now the coach comes and asks him to move back. And, of course, he does it, because he's the ultimate team guy. And then 2 seasons later, Gordy came out of retirement and joined the WHA. He moved over from the Houston Aeros to the New England Whalers in 1977-78 and joined up again with Tom Webster, who played on his right wing. Gordy was at center ice, and his son Mark was on left wing. What a great line. Gordy came up to Webby and said, "Listen, I don't have the touch like you do right now, so you just make your way out into the slot. I'll go into the corners and I'll find the puck for you." At 49 years of age, Gordy would go into the corners instead of making the young guys do it. But that's the way Gordy Howe was. All Gordy wanted to do was play hockey. He didn't seem to worry about the money. He felt he could put his trust in Jack Adams, and in return, Jack would treat him fairly. Gordy had only one request as a player during salary negotiations with Jack. He didn't want anyone to be paid more than he was. It was a fair request, considering that he was often the best player in the game. It was Bob Baughn who broke the trust Gordy had in the front office. He'd been drafted by Oakland in the 1967 expansion draft, and then was traded to Detroit in 1968. Baughn was famous for a goal he scored for the Leafs in the sixth game of the 1964 Stanley Cup Finals against Detroit. Halfway through the third period, with a score tied 3-3, he broke his ankle blocking a Gordy Howe shot while killing a penalty. Baughn went to the dressing room, had his ankles shot up with freezing and taped, and came back out. He scored in overtime, and the Leafs went on to win the Cup in Game 7. In 1970, Gordy and Baughn and some other vets decided to take the rookies to lunch. Back then, players didn't discuss their salaries. But Baughn was the president of the new Players Association, so this was not idle conversation when the talk turned to contracts and money. Baughn disclosed his contract. He was making more than Gordy Howe. Gordy was very, very hurt. It was a tremendous blow to his ego, or his pride, or whatever you want to call it. He felt betrayed because of all the sacrifices he'd made based on the loyalty he had for the Red Wings. Gordy was so upset that he went down and talked to owner Bruce Norris. Gordy was given the $100,000 a year raise he requested, but the incident had destroyed his trust in management. That's when Gordy's wife, Colleen, stepped in. Her attitude was, "I won't let this happen again. I'm going to take care of my husband, and I'm going to take care of my boys." She became their manager, the first female player agent in the NHL. I give her a tremendous amount of credit for that. When Gordy Howe retired from the NHL a second time in 1980, the league and the game lost a player the likes of which we would never see again. He was a legend even when he was still playing. One glimpse of his greatness is reflected in the career of another true legend of the game, Bobby Orr. Bobby's first NHL All-Star game was in 1969. Gordy played in that game. In fact, he got into a rare All-Star game fight with Mike Walton, then of the Maple Leafs. It's hard to believe, but Gordy's first All-Star game was in 1948, the year Bobby was born, and Gordy dropped the gloves in that game, too. Most astonishing of all is that Gordy's final All-Star game was in 1980, 2 years after Orr had retired. That game was at Joe Louis Arena, and even though Gordy was returning as a member of the Hartford Whalers, the crowd gave their hero a standing ovation that went on for minutes. I was there. It was my first All-Star game, and his 23rd. The players were introduced one by one. As each guy skated out to his blue line, the announcer called out his name and the team he was representing. Gordy was the last one to step on the ice. The crowd spontaneously rose to its feet as his name was called, and he was introduced as representing not this or that team, but all of hockey. The applause went on for several minutes. The adoration of that crowd and the humility on Gordy's face is something I will never forget. No matter how you look at it, his numbers are staggering. He scored 801 goals in a defensively oriented league with a straight blade back when the season was only about 60 games long. And that doesn't count the 174 goals and 508 points he scored in the WHA. He was among the top five scorers for 20 consecutive seasons. I may have broken some of his records, but I never came close to that, and no one ever will. And there's another record no one will ever come close to. Gordy scored 20 goals in the NHL as a 50-year-old. Anyone who can do that at 40 is a legend. No one is ever going to do it at 50 again. Like the true sportsman Gordy is, he went on the road with us in 1994 when I was with the Kings and close to breaking his record of 801 goals. It got kind of crazy, and after about 2 weeks, we were beginning to wonder how long we could ask Gordy Howe to follow us around. I was certainly feeling pressure. I idolized Gordy and felt as if I was letting him down. What was really crazy was that in each game I was using 9 sticks, 3 sets of gloves, and 3 or 4 different helmets. In a record-setting situation, everybody wants something when the big goal is scored. The Hall of Fame wanted something, the NHL wanted something, the team wanted something, and on it goes. We were at home on March 23, 1994, when Vancouver came in. The Canucks played a big game and were a good skating club, so it was always tough to go up against them. But at 14 minutes and 47 seconds of the second period on our power play, the right guys were on the ice. Marty McSorley, Luke Robitaille, and Jari Kurri. Luke made a drop pass to me just inside the blue line, and I gave it to Marty, who returned it cross ice. I picked it out of the air past the middle of the right circle and put it in past Kirk McLean. Of all the goals I scored in my career, that goal meant the most because of the connection to Gordy Howe, the greatest of them all. Chapter 15. Willie O'Ree. Willie O'Ree is one of those great characters in hockey. Born in 1935, he was the first black player in the NHL and paved the way for guys like Tony McKegney, Grant Fuhr, Anson Carter, Jerome Iginla, and P.K. Subban. Although his parents were born in Canada and he grew up in Fredericton, his grandparents had been slaves who came through the Underground Railroad to Nova Scotia and from there to New Brunswick. But O'Ree's childhood story wasn't just about race. He was a lot like any other Canadian kid who fell in love with hockey. When he was only 3 years old, his dad gave him his first pair of skates. They were basically blocks of wood with double blades on the bottom and straps that went over your shoes. With the 2 blades on each foot, they worked like training wheels, O'Ree would lean on a chair and push himself back and forth across the backyard rink. When O'Ree was a kid, there were only two black families in Fredericton, and all his friends were white. Still, he later said that he could have been purple for all the difference it made. He wouldn't learn about racial discrimination in hockey or in life until later. As he saw it, in those early days, black meant puck and white meant ice. As O'Ree grew older, he became aware that there were things he couldn't do and places he couldn't go. When he was a teenager, it was pretty much impossible to have a girlfriend. There were no black girls his age at school. It was an unwritten rule, but very much understood by everyone, that white girls were off limits for a black man. O'Ree would have secret crushes on girls, but that's as far as it went. He also couldn't go into the barber shop. There were no signs, but it was understood that it was a white barber shop. O'Ree was good friends with the barber's son, Joe McQuaid, so he asked him what would happen if he went in for a haircut. Joe said he didn't know. So one afternoon, Willie walked in and sat down, and Mr. McQuaid cut Willie's hair. Joe's father was criticized for it, but he always took care of Willie. O'Ree made up his mind then and there that he wasn't going to let prejudice stand in his way. He played every sport, baseball, basketball, tennis, volleyball, soccer. But mostly, he loved hockey. He'd listen to Foster Hewitt's play-by-play on Hockey Night in Canada on the radio every Saturday night. His favorite players were Rocket Richard and Gordie Howe. When O'Ree finally made the NHL, he once found himself in the corner with Gordie and got a face full of the famous Howe elbow. As Gordie skated away with the puck, he called back to Willie, "Keep your head up, rookie." In his first year in high school, O'Ree was good enough to make the Fredericton Junior Capitals. A year later, he moved up to the Senior Capitals. When he turned 19, he moved on to Major Junior with the Quebec Frontenacs, where he made $60 a week. That was great money for a kid in those days, and it was enough to help his family buy their first house for $3,000. His family had always been renters, so that was a big day. O'Ree's coach in Quebec was Phil Watson, who'd played 13 years in the NHL with the Rangers and Canadiens. Phil told Willie that he had the skills to play in the NHL, but that people might not accept him because he was black. The next year, Willie went to play for the Kitchener-Waterloo Canucks in Ontario with Hall of Famer Blackjack Stewart coaching, the teammate Gordie Howe had got tangled up with the night of his dangerous head injury. Then something happened that threatened O'Ree's NHL dream. A shot from the point deflected off Willie's stick and struck him in the right eye, breaking his nose and his cheek. After the operation on his eye, the surgeon, Dr. Henry Soon, came into the recovery room. "Mr. O'Ree," he said, "the impact of the puck completely shattered the retina in your right eye. You're going to be blind in that eye, and you'll never play hockey again." 10 days later, the 19-year-old was back on his skates. He kept the news about being blind in one eye to himself. Instead, as a left-handed left winger, he learned to compensate by turning his head all the way around to the right to pick the puck up. At first, he was overskating the puck and missing the net. And then he told himself, "Forget about what you can't see and just concentrate on what you can see." So his game started to improve. He scored a few goals, and then the season ended. That's when Punch Imlach, who was with the Quebec Aces, asked him to come to training camp. Imlach signed O'Ree for $3,500 plus a $500 signing bonus and another bonus if he scored 20 goals. In 1949, O'Ree's baseball team in Fredericton had won a league championship and was rewarded with a trip to New York that included a Dodgers game at Ebbets Field to meet the great Jackie Robinson, who'd broken baseball's color barrier with the Dodgers 2 years earlier. The kids lined up after the game, and Jackie shook their hands. He was about to move on when Willie told him that he was a hockey player. Jackie stopped and said, "I didn't realize there were any black kids playing hockey." And Willie said, "Yeah, there's a few." Herb Carnegie, a center who played senior hockey in the 1940s and 50s, had come close. Conn Smythe would say of him, "Somebody get me a paintbrush. If I could paint him white, he'd make the team." Carnegie played in the Quebec Provincial League with Jean Béliveau, who saw him as a super hockey player with a beautiful style, a beautiful skater, a great playmaker. In those days, the younger ones learned from the older ones. I learned from Herbie. Carnegie was also part of the first all-black line in the league, known as the Black Aces. He played center, while his brother Ossie and Manny McIntyre were wingers. Named most valuable player in 1946, 1947, and 1949, he tried out for the New York Rangers in 1948. But there were some racial problems there, too. Although he was among the best players at camp, he was only offered a contract to play in the minors. Carnegie decided to stay in Quebec, where the money was better. O'Ree, too, spent time in an American training camp when the Milwaukee Braves of baseball's National League brought him down to Georgia. It was his first time in the Deep South, and he was shocked. He had to stay in a blacks-only hotel, and for the first time in his life, he was told to sit at the back of the bus. But at the end of the tryout, he too headed back to Canada to play hockey. After all, O'Ree liked playing with the Aces. For a short time in 1958, O'Ree played on an all-black line with Stan Maxwell and 20-year-old John Uytendale, who would later play with Mark Messier's father Doug on the junior Edmonton Oil Kings. Willie's teammates and their hometown fans in Quebec treated him well, but when the Aces went on the road, fans in other rinks would call him names. There was no glass between the penalty box, and sometimes they'd spit and throw drinks on him. Opposition players went after him, too. There was a lot of name-calling, stick work, elbows, and hits from behind. But Willie gave as good as he got. He had to let them know he wasn't an easy mark, or they'd run all over him. One day, Lynn Patrick, the Bruins GM, invited O'Ree to the Bruins training camp. Willie framed the letter and still has it today. On January 18, 1958, he was told to meet the team in Montreal. He'd been called up to replace Leo Labine, who had the flu. It was a Saturday night, so the Forum game was broadcast on Hockey Night in Canada. Willie played on a line with Don McKinney and Jerry Tappazzini against his childhood hero Rocket Richard, as well as Jean Béliveau, Doug Harvey, and Jacques Plante. The Bruins beat the Canadiens 3-0 that night. O'Ree had no idea of the game's significance until he opened the newspaper the next morning to see his name and the box scores and a couple of lines in the third paragraph saying that he was the first Negro ever to play in the NHL at left wing for the Bruins. But once O'Ree got into the league, the name-calling escalated. Not so much in Canada, where he was known from his junior days, but in Detroit, Chicago, and New York. If Willie told the refs, they'd brush him off. Eric Nestoranko, a winger with the Blackhawks who finished his career with over 1,000 penalty minutes, once skated up to O'Ree and made racial comments during the warm-up. He knew then that he would have to fight Nestoranko that night. 7 minutes in, Nestoranko butt-ended him in the mouth. He broke O'Ree's nose, split his lip, and knocked out his two front teeth. Then he stood over him, calling him the N-word several times. But that wasn't what set Willie off. Nestoranko just stood there and laughed at him, daring him to do something about it. Willie thought, "You have to do something now, or he'll be chasing you the rest of the year." So Willie clubbed him over the head with his stick. Nestoranko needed 15 stitches. O'Ri was traded to Montreal right after they won 5 Stanley Cups in a row. Montreal was so deep that he was sent to the minors in Hull, Ottawa, and then traded to the WHL's Los Angeles Blades, where he was moved to right wing. That meant the passes and the checks came at him from the left, where he could see them. So his totals jumped to 38 goals and 28 assists, and he won the goal-scoring title in 1965 and in 1969. In Los Angeles in 1962, O'Ree was at an NAACP luncheon in Jackie Robinson's honor. Robinson was standing over in the corner when Willie's coach brought Willie and a couple of other players over to meet him. He said, "Mr. Robinson, I'd like to introduce you to a couple of players. This is Willie O'Ree, newly acquired from Canada to join our team." And Mr. Robinson looked Willie in the eye and said, "Willie O'Ree, you're the young fellow I met in Brooklyn. Obviously, you don't forget a guy like Willie O'Ree." Chapter 16. Stand Firm. No one is exactly sure where the game of hockey started. Some people think it is a Canadian adaptation of the traditional Irish sport of hurling. Others claim it was an invention of students at McGill University in Montreal. But there is a solid claim that a sport not unlike hockey was played by native North Americans before Europeans ever arrived. Certainly, some of the first hockey sticks were made by the Mi'kmaq First Nation in Nova Scotia. In fact, the Mi'kmaq stick was the most popular stick in the game in the first decades of the 20th century and was used by Lord Stanley's sons. Even though the First Nations were part of the evolution of the game from the very beginning, it wasn't until 1954 that Fred Sisakamoose, a short, speedy center with great skills, became the very first Aboriginal player to make the NHL. Fred grew up on the Etaka-Coupe Reserve in Sandy Lake, Saskatchewan. His Cree name, pronounced Ta-Saw, means stand firm, and that is the man he became. When Fred was very young, his grandfather, who was deaf and mute, would put him in a sleigh and take him to the slough near their cabin to play hockey. He would scrape off a bit of the ice and help Fred pull on 3 or 4 pairs of socks and a pair of moccasins, and then he'd slide a little pair of box skates over the boy's feet, and then his grandfather would hand him a little hockey stick that he'd whittled from a willow branch. Fred's grandfather would stand Fred up and let him go, and then turn his own attention to chopping a hole in the ice to fish. Fred would rush around, pushing a chunk of frozen horse manure all over with his stick. When he fell down, his grandfather would pull himself up off his seat on an upside-down 5-gallon pail, pick Fred up, and make him try again. Later in the day, when it got too cold, his grandfather would pack up and take Fred home. He would hold the boy on his knee in front of the stove, warming him up by rubbing his back while he peeled off the frozen layers of his outer clothing. All 6 members of Fred's family lived in a tiny, mud-padded log house. His mother used to braid Fred's and his brother Frank's hair every day. There was no such thing as welfare in those days. If you didn't work, you starved. The closest hospital was 80 miles away in Prince Albert. The family used traditional medicine, roots, leaves, grass, whatever was taught, and that's how they survived. They lived off the land, and they were happy. In 1940, when Fred was 6 years old, an RCMP officer, a government agent, and a Catholic priest came for him and his brother. They pulled into the yard in a 3-ton truck already filled with crying children. His grandfather tried to pull Fred close to protect him. Fred could see the tears dropping down his cheeks. But the government agent shoved the old man back. It was the last time Fred ever saw his grandfather. He died that winter. It took about 5 hours to get to Duck Lake Residential School. The first thing the priest did when the boys arrived was cut off their braids. Then they poured coal oil, which is like kerosene, over their heads. Next, They threw the boys into a large steam bath, about 30 or 40 kids at a time. Fred remembers how he sweated in that steam bath and how the coal oil burned his eyes. His parents were only 120 miles away, but they were not allowed to see their boys for 2 years. In the spring of 1943 or 1944, when Fred was 9 years old, he and a friend named Charlie ran away. They made it to the banks of the Saskatchewan River, about 10 miles from the school. The river was a couple of hundred yards wide, a long way across. But Fred was too ashamed to go back and face the teasing from the other kids, so he and Charlie waded in. They made it about 5 or 6 feet when they got caught in the current. Later, Sisakamoose would say that river didn't want them to drown, so it swept them back to the shoreline. The priests eventually found them and brought them back. But first they took their shoes. They made the boys walk all the way back in bare feet on the gravel.